WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
When Creative Time, a public art organization, decided to place an exhibit inside the Domino Sugar Refinery, it tapped artist Kara Walker. When she saw this 30,000-square-foot space, she decided to reach into the building's past.
Since coming to prominence, the artist Kara Walker has asked us to deal with some of the most insidious parts of our history. Walker became famous with paper cutouts in a style that seemed Victorian. She borrowed racist imagery from a past century to explore race, gender, violence, and power in our own time. But while the imagery may be painful, Walker's work is also seductive, beautifully realized in forms that are uniquely her own. She joined us last week at the New Yorker Festival for a conversation with Thelma Golden, the director and chief curator of the Studio Museum in Harlem. They discussed a work from a few years back, truly one of a kind, with the title A Subtlety, or The Marvelous Sugar Baby. It's a sphinx made in sugar constructed in a former sugar plant in Brooklyn. It was 75 feet long, really monumental. And as the sugar fermented, the smell also became monumental. The line to see the work was sometimes hours long. Here's Thelma Golden with Kara Walker.
So The Marvelous Sugar Baby very much seems to be a work on one hand, which calls into a moment that I think you have been in for some years, which is really intersects with the conversation in this moment about monument making, right? So that your work seemed to be in some ways responding to the effort towards monument, but in many ways creating a corrective in them. But also A Subtlety also feels as if it's a work that really also talks about this relationship that you have through your work with audience. So could you talk a bit about that work in process as it relates to its form, but also its reception?
Yeah, I mean, the process was arduous. It was long. My brain doesn't work the way I want it to when I need it to do things. There's drawing, there's crying, there's reading, there's writing, and there's making PowerPoints that confuse people that help my mind sort of accumulate images and ideas and feelings. And ultimately, I realized, okay, it is really about the public. It is about creating a space that, you know, where I can, you know, sort of take these ideas about slavery, about the New World, about sugar, about the 1,000 years prior to the New World's discovery, where sugar was a refined, you know, treat for only the most special, you know, a very hard to get treat, all the way into the sort of economics of slavery, the hardships of the sugar plantation, the botany of the sugar cane, you know, and how to distill that or literally refine it into a something that is iconic and easily digestible, but also speaks about the sort of destruction of humanity that this beautiful substance, mm-hmm. tasty substance, has come to represent and has come to be. And I thought, well, I actually have to think like the Havemeyer brothers. You know, I actually have to think about, like, I have a sugar refinery. How do I mm-hmm. entice, you know, and repel at once? So, yeah, ultimately, I started thinking about the Sphinx. I started thinking about tourist attractions. I started thinking about ruins and ruins and ruins and past civilizations, and that this place, this plant was about to be destroyed. It was emblematic of a past civilization, a civilization that we are soon no longer to be a part of.
And you spent some time there watching the audience engage with that work.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a big audience. I think they had 130,000 people over 6 weekends or something crazy lines. And I went a few times just to be there and see it, because it was the thing to be seen. And I couldn't believe that it was, that I was responsible for it, because people had so many varied and amazing responses to the work, tears and worship and, you know, selfies and, you know, rudeness and, you know, tasting. And, you know, it was really a sensory experience.
Really digging into this idea of monuments, I'd love for you to talk about what it meant to grow up in mm-hmm. the literal shadow of Stone Mountain.
Well, Stone Mountain, just briefly, is, you know, we moved from Decatur to Stone Mountain when I was 15. And the first thing that happened was we got a notice, well, an American flag and a notice in our mailbox about the Klan rally down on Memorial Drive. This was in 1985, because the Klan at that time still owned a part of the land that Stone Mountain Park is, that is, you know, occupied by the park. So at the time that I moved there, I was not really keen on visiting the park, but it was there and it was a destination for, you know, everybody in my school and neighborhood. And it's been this looming, strange, permanent artifact that I've learned more and more about over the last, you know, 25 years, I guess.
You've been making art since you were a child, but I want to know when you thought you were an artist. When did the idea occur to you?
Right. I mean, it's funny because I think, yes, I always kind of thought of, I have my father as a painter. I thought, you know, I spent around a lot of time as a child around people who said they were artists. So I just thought I was an artist, but I didn't really realize that I wasn't an artist until I was in graduate school. And I started to sort of, you know, really take stock of my own privilege, in a way, the privilege of, you know, being around artists. And I thought, well, I want my work to have meaning. I want my work to have have reach. I want my work to have range. And the work that I was looking at that I really thought that really spoke to me was work that hit a very hard note, you know, that talked about history, the German expressionists, for, you know, just the easy example. But there were other artists. I mean, certainly the work in the Black Arts Movement, you know, was really going hard at, you know, trying to right the wrongs of, you know, our history and of, you know, to really sort of plumb the depths of one's, you know, personal experience, but as it relates to social experiences, social history. But I think that I had to grow up into that, you know.
The artist Kara Walker, speaking with Thelma Golden. More to come.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
You, through your imagination and this engagement in history, have created for many an alternative narrative, right? And so much of your work, Kara, for me, has been about the way in which you've taken a personal path through an imagining of perhaps the stories we haven't heard or the ways in which perhaps they might not have been told. Can you talk about this role of narrative in your work?
Sure. I mean, I think, again, sort of talking about influences and narrative, you know, kind of trying to understand where narratives of Black womanhood exist. They're primarily, you know, at least in the past, in the form of, you know, personal slave narratives and narratives of overcoming hardship or trying to overcome hardship. And so the truth, the sort of documentary, the personal documentary, the biography, the autobiography. And within the autobiography, I guess there's this kind of the problem of audience. In the course of autobiography, you have unsavory elements that maybe an audience of good Christian abolitionists doesn't exactly want to hear. So then euphemism becomes key, or, you know, a strong euphemism, but a, you know, key euphemism about, you know, about rape, about perhaps about a kind of strange and complicit feeling of complicity that perhaps the narrator is trying to wrestle with, right? How did I wind up in this situation that I was trying to protect my children, you know, or I was trying to set my children free or whatever. But there's a complexity, I think, to, you know, the experience of a woman in slavery that is harder to narrate, and that space is very interesting. The space of what's unspoken, what's unsaid, because it is both unsayable and very familiar. You know, just thinking abstractly, that's where the silhouette, or the sort of as a blank space, kind of becomes a representative of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And can you talk a little bit about what led you to the silhouette as a form?
It was the blank space, really. I was thinking a lot about, you know, part about the blank spaces within these narratives, and thinking about my own sort of heart and sort of the stuff that I'm kind of made up of. I was really thinking about the sort of compression of stereotypes and ideas and misrepresentations coming from outside of me that were sort of building. And thinking, you know, just part of it was an abstraction. Part of it was thinking about Blackness, thinking about skin, thinking about that being a covering rather than an identity. And of course, you know, I was looking at a lot of historical imagery. I was thinking about identity, and I was thinking about my own growth, but I was also linking it with the sort of identity of America. Like, what is its representation? What does it look like? And I thought it also looks like this kind of blank space.
You know, in so many ways, you mine, right, the horror of what we know is the legacy of slavery, of racism, the violence of it. Can you talk about that part of your process and your practice, what it means to be mining such complexity in the work visually and through language and text?
I should be able to talk about it by now, but I think as far as part of the process, there is a, you know, an aspect that just feels necessary. You know, I think that mining my own depths, I dare say I've been accused in my childhood and other parts of my life of being too self-revelatory, of, say, saying the wrong thing in a joking way that is, you know, self-deprecating to a fault, or too revealing, or revealing in a way that upsets the group. So I did, I think, at some point, stop talking. But it shows up in the work, sometimes without my even realizing it.
Well, I think there's a prescience to the work. You know, in the past moment you said, my work is all about the now. And it seems to me that even when your work is cited in these historic moments, that you are often commenting about what happens in the present.
Exactly. I mean, I think that what I set out to do, in a way, worked too well, was just to say, well, if I pretty everything up with hoop skirts and Southern bells, then nobody will recognize, you know, that I'm talking about them. And then they didn't. You know, they said, oh, this is, the past is so bad, and I'm not from the past, you know, even if I make drawings that, you know, suggest that, you know, this is what I could have, you know, had access to, you know, like stylistically or something. It's not the case. I do live here now. And so do you.
When I have encountered your drawings, I always think of the amazing Audre Lorde quote, which she said of herself, "I am my best work, a series of roadmaps, reports, recipes, doodles, and prayers from the front lines." It feels to me your drawing practice is somehow embedded and engaged in that idea, that it forms the connective tissue between past work and present work. Can you talk specifically about this moment of lockdown and then the ongoing period and what that has meant for your work and particularly your drawing practice?
Yeah, I mean, drawing is, it's important to me just to know that I exist. I think it's a connective, it is the connective tissue between my mind and, you know, my feeling, my heart, and the outside. You know, being able to sort of put it down on paper is really something that I feel is a you know, a blessing, a privilege, and, you know, and also a burden and a chore, you know, to have to, you know, remember to do it and, you know, not forget. And it's shocking and it surprises me every time that, you know, when a drawing feels good to me, that I didn't have a thought. I didn't know that it was what was coming, but it makes perfect sense. So I've been doing a lot of sitting down, just very kind of basic, nice sheet of paper, pencils, watercolors, maybe some ink. And that's been keeping me going through this period of lockdown, through a lot of ups and downs, you know, emotionally, a lot of some losses, some tragedies, some high points here and there. But it's like the through line for me is being able to sit at my table, wherever my table happens to be, you know, and do some drawings.
The artist Kara Walker speaking with Thelma Golden of the Studio Museum. Walker's work is on exhibit in Chicago at the Disabled Museum. Their conversation was recorded at the New Yorker Festival, which is still going on. You can find out more at newyorker.com/festival. That's our program for today. I'm David Remnick. Thank you for joining us. Hope you have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.